Georgie, tie a biter. He's a spy and a girl delighter. Georgie, firefighter. He's a student like you.
Our next guest on Downtown has had a remarkable career from Broadway to television, films, video game, and of course is one of the founding members of the incredibly influential comedy group Fire Sign Theater. We are pleased to welcome to Downtown, not Ralph Spoilsports, but Phil Proctor. Phil, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon to you. And it sounds like you've got a full studio there, right? You have two other guys in there with you?
We do. It's kind of like a circus act.
Well, there were four of us in the Fire Sign Theater, a satirical comedy group that reigned from the late 60s until, for 50 years we had a career. We reigned. But then the great drought came, and there's no more rain here in Southern California. In fact, Rich, I'm calling you from up on the upper patio of my canyon home near Benedict Canyon near Beverly Hills, area code 90210, and I'm actually brushing the ash off of the table, which was the fallout from a fire that we had a couple of days ago that was scarily close to where I live right now.
That is very scary indeed. Well, Phil, your new book is absolutely wonderful. It's called Where's My Fortune Cookie? I want to get it right, my psychic surrealistic story. You've also got a new podcast out, but the book, I couldn't read it fast enough. I wanted to go back and read it again. So many incredible stories, and I don't even know where to begin. But let's start with the role that the psychic phenomena and psychic activity has played in your life. It started early, and it's something that has never gone away for you.
No, that's true. As you will know, if you read the book, which is available, by the way, to Amazon.com, or at FireSignTheater.com, or at PlanetProctor.com. If you read the book, you'll learn, or hear the podcast, you'll learn that I was born of Irish and Amish ancestry, very unusual combination. And a book was written about my family called Rosanna of the Amish, which gets into all of that. That actually became a podcast TV show on the Internet years ago. In any event, I seem to have been born with high psychic abilities from both sides of the family, because as you will see in the book, there are a bunch of strange things that happen. And in fact, my whole Fire Sign Theater career was connected to odd coincidences and amazing timing. But the book starts off with a bang, as you know, when Peter Bergman and I, who were touring as half the wits of the Fire Sign Theater, had performed up in San Francisco and went for a late-night meal, like at 2:30 in the morning, to a very famous Chinese restaurant called the Golden Dragon. And no sooner was I bending over my second bowl of soup when these three nutty Chinese guys who represented the Joe Fong gang, the Joe Fong gang, came into the place to try to shoot up the watching, who were sitting in the back of the restaurant and were obviously watching them come in, because they went under the table. Five people were killed, 11 wounded, in what at the time, in 1977, was described as the worst massacre in American history. Ho, 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 ho. But the point of it is that whole event had been predicted to me a few months earlier by an old girlfriend of mine. She was actually a young girlfriend then, but she's older now, as are we all. And I didn't really think about that until after the shooting was over and we were, I was out on the road performing. We had to perform the next day, Peter and I, at Boulder, Colorado. And I remember Peter said I said, luckily, I was in this gangland shooting, but luckily I ordered the duck. And Peter said, and I ordered the scared prunes. And yes, indeed, we both escaped with our lives. But that was a startling psychic event that I thought would be a good kickoff point for the book.
Well, it sure was. You also, along the way, ran into and got to know someone we've talked about here on the program before in regard to his work in remote viewing. One of the most interesting people I've ever read about, Andrei Proharich.
Andrei Proharich, yes, indeed. Well, it so happened that when it's such a strange story, and I believe it's all in the book. But I had become excited when Peter and I were performing in Chicago a few days before a gig in New York, where we were also interviewed for Talk of the Town by The New Yorker, by Tony Hiss, Alger Hiss's son, please. The strange connections go on forever. But anyway, Uri Geller had just begun to perform his magic on television, Bending Spoons et al. And it so happened that I said to Peter, I want to meet this guy. So we go to New York to perform at the Bitter End or the Bottom Line or the Bitter Line. I can't remember what it was. And there was a phone message waiting for me. It said, Uri Geller wants to meet you. Right? Okay? And it's from this girl. It's from somebody named Sharon McCann, whom I didn't know. That's because it was my old friend Sharon who got married. Now she had the last name McCann. And it turns out that she was working with Andrea Poharich and Uri Geller up in Ossining, New York, at this psychic research center that they had created up there. And at the time that I was performing, they were in Israel talking to aliens in the desert. Okay, so they weren't available. They weren't available to meet me. But later on, Andrea got together with Peter and me, and we had a lunch with him. And he described how he was receiving messages from the aliens through his watch, because he had a watch that was in Hebrew, but it told the time in Israel and in his present location in New York. And he said that there was some formula that he used, some Hebraic numerical formula that he used in order to translate the stopping of his watch. They would stop his watch at certain times, and he would have to write down the letter that was signified, and that's how they were communicating with him. Okay, fine. So after this meeting, we go back to our hotel to get ready for our act that night, and I can't get into my room, okay? Now, I have to preface this by saying one of the things that Sharon told me on the night that we spent together when she predicted this gangland shooting, saying that you were going to be in the middle of a gangland shooting with foreigners involved, people will be killed and wounded around you, it'll be after a performance, but you and Peter will emerge unscathed. All right. But she said to me during that night, she said, the sign that the aliens are telling you that they like what you and Peter are doing, because we were playing aliens in our act, by the way, is that lights will be going on and off around you. Well, this has been going on now for 40 years of lights going on and off around me. I think I tell some of the stories in the book, and I don't dare start to tell you all of them now. But it's significant and it's real and it keeps happening to me. So we go back to my hotel room, and I'm going to get ready for the act. I can't get into my room, so we call the detective. It was the Barbizon Plaza, I believe. We called the house Dick, and he comes up, and he has these things, and he opens the door, and the light is on in the room. The ceiling light is on in the room. And he says to me, he said, you know, I had to actually throw the lock, the inside lock. And he said, you know, you can only do that if you're in the room. You know, when you're in a hotel room and you turn the thing on, he said, you can only do that if there's someone in the room. And there was nobody in the room. So he couldn't explain that either. Okay? Please, it goes on and on. I don't spend too much time thinking about this stuff. I'm just aware of it. And that's what I would say to your listeners. If you really want guidance of any sort, you know, listen to those little inner voices of yours and be observant as to what's happening around you. Not only can it save your life, but it will also help to guide you through life and put you, and I think move you in the right direction towards the good things that can happen to you.
Phil, you've had so many successes in your life, but I learned from reading the book that you were also part of what Mel Brooks has said was the only failure in his career.
Yeah, that's right. There was a wonderful film that came out a couple of decades ago called The Travelers, which I think in French is called Les Visiteurs, The Visitors. And it was a great hit for Gaumont Production Company. And it was about a medieval knight and his serf who have to come to have to time travel through a wizard's a brew into modern France in order to right a wrong that happened way back in like the 13th century, okay? And it's a very, very funny comedy. Well, it was all in French, of course, and even though it was very successful with subtitles, Mel Brooks and a group of other people decided we're going to put it out overdubbed in English. So I was lucky enough to be cast in one of the major roles, along with a whole bunch of other talented, wonderful people. And we went in, and for weeks, we very laboriously matched our American words to the French lip movements. And Mel thought it would be really funny if we all did it with a French accent. Because, of course, a French accent is very funny. You know, think of Clouseau. It's not my dog, you know? It's funny. So we are all speaking with, you know, these French accents. The problem was that the French that they were using in this movie was a very fast kind of slangy Parisian French. And they swallow their words and they talk very, very fast. So here we are talking French, you know, with French accents very fast to try to think to match the lip movements. Well, when they played the film in Encino to a test audience, they thought we were speaking French. Okay? And even though we had been invited to a cast and crew screening, we never were sent tickets to that screening. And we learned later that they were so, that they just decided we can't release this movie. And yes, indeed, as Mel has told me, this was the only failure he ever had in his wonderful long career, which is still going on. God bless him.
We're talking with Phil Proctor here on Downtown. We recently lost talented Harry Anderson, who was a great friend of yours. You encouraged him to pursue his career, go to Los Angeles. So what do you remember best about Harry?
Well, you know, right before I went off to the Here Now Festival in Kansas City, which was a major audio festival last weekend, where they premiered my podcast of Where's My Fortune Cookie, which you can catch up with on Podbean, podbean.com. This Friday, you'll hear the second episode. And right before I left, there were two memorials for Harry. One of them was at the Magic Castle, naturally. And there's one quote that I have been using for quite a few years that Harry came up with that I think will be pertinent to all of you sitting in that studio there at WZON. And here's what he said. He said, "Magic and radio are very similar. It has to be believed to be seen."
Absolutely. That's great.
Isn't that beautiful? Luckily, my wife, Melinda Peterson, and I got to spend some time with Harry in his new house in Ashland, in Asheville, excuse me. I'm still wiping ash off of my table here. Ash and ye shall leave. Anyway, in Asheville and North Carolina. And he had moved from another house, and he had all kinds of strange carnival stuff in there, like a two-headed baby in formaldehyde. And I said, "So Harry, did you move your electric chair as well?" And he said, "Oh, Phil, you haven't heard. I have two electric chairs now." Okay, how many friends do you have who have two electric chairs? Oh, he was such a dear friend. And he was so loyal to all of us and stayed in touch always. Whenever he was in town to perform, we would, you know, be invited and have VIP treatment and hang out with him and his beautiful daughter, Ava. They did a mind-reading act together that was absolutely mind-boggling. And he will be sorely missed. But a day doesn't go by where I don't think of something funny that he said to me.
We're talking with Phil Proctor. His new book is fantastic. It's called Where's My Fortune Cookie? I learned that you were there and played a role, obviously, in helping Cloris Leachman get high for the first time.
Yes, and actually, I've just learned that there are home movies of this happening on a DVD release that the Firesign Theater put out a couple of months ago called Everything You Know Is Wrong, the Firesign Theater Declassified. And it's a two DVD set of our rare television and film appearances, and among the home movies, which comprise of part of the second DVD, there were apparently pictures of us turning Cloris Leachman on in the desert of the Laguna Ensalada in Mexico, where we were all getting together to film the only movie that Firesign Theater actually wrote is called Zachariah, starring John Rubenstein and Don Johnson. And we were out scouting locations in the desert, and Cloris's husband, George Eastman, was that his name? Anyway, her husband was directing the film, producing and directing the film, and at that time she wasn't with us. He wasn't with us, and so indeed we were smoking some good Mexican dope, and she'd never turned on before. She loved it. And the next thing I know, she won an Academy Award. Right? So it can't be all bad, boys.
Oh, there you go. Well, we have to talk about Firesign Theater because of the incredible damage it did to my adolescent psyche back in the day. It all began with Radio Free Oz with Peter Bergman.
Yeah, and I'd gone to Yale with Peter Bergman, and he'd written the lyrics for two musicals by Austin Pendleton, who is a legendary name back east. And I starred in them. One was Tom Jones, and I played Tom, and the other was Booth Is Back in Town. I played Edwin Booth, and Peter and I became acquainted through the work in the theater. And then we lost touch. And in the book, it points out that I had a romantic liaison with the beautiful Susan Anspach, who passed away maybe 3 or 4 months ago, broke my heart. Peter showed up at my door in Greenwich Village on West 11th Street with a guitar wearing an army uniform, and he proceeded to serenade me and Susan at breakfast with working songs, you know, this land is made of mountains, this land is made of mud. So that was amazing. And then off he went, disappeared again many years later after understudying Brandon DeWilde in a play on Broadway. Brandon DeWilde, for the older people in the audience, you remember him as the little boy yelling, "Shane, Shane, come back, Shane." Okay. He went on to have a pretty good career in films. And at the time that I connected with him, understudying him in a play called Race of Hairy Men, he was actually trying, he had learned to play the guitar, and he was trying to move his career into a singing career. So I met all these wonderful musicians at the time. We decided to go out to L.A. together. We connected up with Peter Fonda, Don't Ask, and we ended up on the Sunset Strip on the night of the infamous Sunset Strip riots, which happened because the youth were trying to impose a curfew on the young people to keep them from protesting the Vietnamese War and openly smoking dope on the street. And so the Sheriff's Department and the L.A. Police Department performed one of these pincer movements, getting all of us in the middle. And I sat down in protest with Peter and Brandon, and I sat down on Peter Bergman's face, or actually a picture of it. It was an open edition of the L.A. Free Press, the beloved Freep, and I pulled it out from under my butt, and it said, KPFK newsman Peter Bergman interviews returning Vietnam War veterans. So after this whole evening was over, where, you know, Peter got beaten up and Brandon got arrested, and I was writing for the East Village Other, so I had a press card with a big I on it, and that apparently scared the police, so they didn't touch me, because I held it up, and they just, you know, swarmed around me like a hot knife through butter. So the next day I call Peter. He says, "Yeah, I'm the Wizard of Oz on a show that I've created called Radio Free Oz on listener-supported radio, KPFK. Why don't you come down? I'm on 5 nights a week, and we'll play." I go down there. I meet these two other bozos, Phil Austin and David Osman, who are associated with the show. We discover we're all fire signs. I'm a Leo. Peter's a Sagittarian. David's a Sagittarian. Austin, unfortunately, is an Aries, but it's still a fire sign. And we started improvising together that very first night, and we discovered that, like long-lost jazz musicians getting together to gig, we played off of one another beautifully, and the Oz Fire Sign Theater was born.
And so many great albums, live performances, radio appearances, the movie Zachariah that you mentioned. And you must have been, I have to think, you're the first people in comedy that got, as you point out, heckled with your own material.
Yeah, well, we were very unique in many ways. The Fire Sign Theater got a contract with Columbia Records because of the fame of Radio Free Oz. Peter Bergman created the first love-in on Easter weekend in Elysian Field, and like 60,000 people showed up. The first love-in. And that was an amazing event that drew great attention to him. So a producer named Gary Usher at Columbia said he wanted to do a Radio Free Oz album. And Phil Austin said, no, you want to do an Oz Fire Sign Theater album. And he said, anything you want. So we went in and we did this. We had to drop the Oz because Disney was doing an animated feature called Back to Oz, and they sent us a nasty letter that the rat signed himself, said you can't use the name Oz. So we didn't, which, you know, Fire Sign Theater is confusing enough, so that's fine. And we did our first record, and it was moderately successful, but a guy named John McClure, one of the suits at Columbia, went into a meeting where they were about ready to drop us and said, you got to keep these guys signed. They're going to do great things. They've invented a long-form, multi-layered comedy format that's going to be revolutionary, which indeed it was. And he signed us to a spoken arts contract. That meant that for a reduced royalty, and we don't believe in royalty in this country anyway, even though we do have President Trump with a crown on his head, but a reduced royalty, we got unlimited free studio time. And that's why we were able to create all of these complex albums. And now I want to share something with you guys. I can say this now. The Firesign Theater's archives have just been purchased by the Library of Congress in Washington, AC/DC, for $500,000.
Wow.
Wow.
Okay?
That is incredible.
So you can celebrate with me over this wonderful, wonderful happening, you know. So it's pretty amazing. About 7 years ago, they inducted one of our albums, which I'm sure you remember, Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers, okay, which predicted channel surfing, among other things, into the historical or hysterical recordings in Washington, D.C., along with Jimi Hendrix's work and Martha and the Vandellas, whom we had lunch with in Washington when for the ceremony to induct the album. And now they have put the cherry on the top of the sundae by purchasing our archives.
Well, you guys predicted a lot of things in Firesign Theater.
Yeah, we did. We did indeed. One of my favorites, we did an album called I Think We're All Bozos on This Bus. Okay? Now, I have an iPhone in my hand, and I'm going to say something to Siri. Hold on a minute. This is Worker speaking. Hello.
Hello, Auckland. Function, can I perform for you? LOL.
Okay. Now, for those of you who know the album, I played a character called Clem. And when the computer asked for my name, I hesitated. Clem. So I became known as Clem to the computer. And what I was basically playing in this album, I Think We're All Bozos on This Bus, which predicted the computer revolution, was I played a disaffected worker at a thing called the Future Fair, which was a government Disneyland designed to make people happy about, you know, the state of their lives. Even though they were unemployed, they could enjoy this free Future Fair. And I became a hacker, and I planted a virus in the mainframe computer, which was called Dr. Memory, Direct Readout Memory. And the question that I asked, it was a koan, that instead of like an actual virus, designed to throw the computer off. Because the computer could only think in yes and no. Plus and minus, all right? That's the way that's computer language. So I asked, I said, why did the porridge bird lay his egg in the air? And the computer could not handle this question, and it brought him down. It destroyed the government computer. And the whole Future Fair, which was holographic and run by the computer, just went away, just disappeared. Well, many years later, I played a major role in, or I should say, a supernumerary role in the Pixar movie Bug's Life, that my Firesign partner David Osman played a larger role in. And at the cast and crew party up in Emeryville, where Pixar has its offices, I met Steve Jobs, who had just purchased, bought into the company because he wanted to help them develop their incredible computer animation. And he said to me when I met him, "I'm a big fan of yours." And I realized he was taller than I was, so I said, "Yes, you are." Now, but what I didn't know was that many years previously, he had been a fan of the Firesign, such a great fan of Firesign Theater, that he showed up at one of our record signing parties at a record store in Berkeley, California. And when we were assembling all of our archives to send to Washington, we came across a bunch of pictures of the young Steve Jobs standing with the Firesign Theater as a
wow.
fan, okay? So he put that homage to the Firesign Theater into the iPhone, and that to me is like, that's really a thrill. That's a thrill.
Fantastic. I want to talk briefly, too, about your remarkable career as a voiceover artist. You mentioned the Pixar films, 14 years as Howard DeVille on Rugrats, Smurfs, video games. How much fun is that for you? Because you continue to do a lot of that.
Well, of course it's fun, because as you get older, Rich, you don't have to learn lines, right?
That's even better.
You go, let me clear my throat. You go into the studio, and there's a script in front of you, which, of course, you've played with before you go in, and you get to do your lines alone several different ways, right? Or you get to interact with your other fellow actors. I remember the first time I got a voiceover job was with Hanna-Barbera. And it was on the Smurfs, okay? And so I went into the studio out in the valley, and I walk into this studio, and there is Jonathan Winters and Alan Young and all of these other heroes of my comedic imagination, inspirational heroes. And I got to sit down at a microphone next to them and play along and do a series of Smurf cartoons. I was finally cast as a character called King Gerard with my little clockwork Smurf. And we did a whole bunch of stuff. And then I did all kinds of other stuff, the Flintstones and Richie Rich and Scooby-Doo, because Hanna-Barbera at the time was the Disney studio for a Saturday morning cartoon.
Right.
And that was my introduction to cartoon work, which has continued right up to this day.
All right, Phil, I would not normally ask this live, but you're just the best there is. So do you think you could do a promo for us, for our show live, and mention you're listening to Downtown with Rich Kimball?
Hello, you stupid fools. This is Rocky Rococo of the Fireside Theater, and you're listening to Downtown, where all the lights are low, and so is the host, Rich Kimball.
That is fantastic. Oh, man.
And you can cut this in. On WZON, you're in the zone.
That is fantastic. Phil, we could talk with you all day. I appreciate you making time for us. I hope we can do this again. The book is wonderful. It's called Where's My Fortune Cookie? Check out the Planet Proctor podcast as well, and I hope we can have you back sometime with us.
I would love to talk to you guys again, although obviously they were struck dumb by our conversation. So I hope you guys have a continued fun conversation together there in Bangor. By the way, is that all Paul Bunyan statue still towering over the city?
It is indeed, but we put up a casino to block his view of the river and to tick him off.
Well, that's the one thing I remember from my visit through Bangor when we were touring around the country. And I'm very happy to have a chance to say hello to everybody up there.
Phil, thank you so much. We wish you continued success. Hope to do it again down the road.
We'll talk again.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
That's the great Phil Proctor here on Downtown. It is 5:31.
I just realized I met him at 237 West 11th Street when I used to live there, but I didn't make the connection until he was just talking.
Wow. Well, there you go. We've got to take a break. We're way behind, but I don't really care because we were talking to Phil Proctor.